You're listening to GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers, now available on iTunes and all other podcast platforms, with new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. GDA Podcast showcases insightful conversations from the best thought leaders, educators, policy experts, motivators, and storytellers on the keynote speaking circuit today. Want today's guest at your next event? Call GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or visit gdaspeakers.com. And now, here's this episode of GDA Podcast with hosts Scale and Kyle Davis. Enjoy.
Our guest on today's episode of GDA Podcast is Mike Shalappi. I have known and worked with Mike for over 15 years, and recently I booked him to speak for a 17-year client. And when I called her for feedback, she simply said, "The best we've ever had." So when Mike Shalappi takes the stage, a dazzling smile greets you, and then you notice a wheelchair. Mike is defined by what he can do instead of what he cannot do. Following a tragic accident, Mike has proven that just because you can't stand up doesn't mean you can't stand out. Welcome to GDA Podcast, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How you guys doing? Thank you for that kind introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, you've always been one of my favorite people, and I purposely left it a little vague because I'm not expecting you to give the full keynote right now, but I would love for you to share in your own words with our listeners your story and why you are in a wheelchair today and what the tragic accident was.
Well, yeah, and I'll try to condense it, but the bottom line is that's actually why I give speeches, why I share my story, is I was just a kid living the dream, and life was good on my way to a football practice, and me and a friend had made some mistakes. We got looking at his dad's off-duty police gun. He thought he emptied it, pointed it at my chest, bang, changed my world. Actually clipped my heart, punctured my lung. Anyway, it ended up hitting my spine, and I've been in a wheelchair as a paraplegic now for 40 years. So that small moment is what caused all this. And on a very personal note, I was actually laying there and running out of air and nobody to help me and thought I was dying. And I kind of made a little promise with heaven or whoever that if I could live, I would help people. And so I really don't consider myself some big speaker that can talk all kinds of subjects and this and that, but I have a desire to get on stage and share my story, and I have just found that it helps people. People laugh, they cry, and, you know, I find they really connect with my challenges, and they want to improve their life, and I've just come to realize that my story helps people, so I continue to do what I love to do. So that's kind of what started this whole thing.
You know, in our industry, there are a lot of overcoming adversity speakers who just simply share what happened and what they're doing and try to offer an inspirational message. One of the things that has always interests me or resonated with me is how you've taken your experience and you've really been able to tailor it to different industries. For example, healthcare. I think you have a background in healthcare, and then with your personal experience, talk a little bit about how you have helped people in the healthcare industry.
Well, yeah, that's an area. I actually ended up going into that world as a profession, partly because of my accident and all the good doctors and nurses and therapists that helped me. So it led me that direction. And then over the years, I not only was saved by wonderful healthcare professionals, but that was my world as a director of rehab for a large hospital system in Utah for 15 years. And that is definitely one of the industries that I love sharing my story for. And, you know, when I come on stage, I don't necessarily maybe know everything about an industry, and I don't try to pretend that I do, but I've often found that if I can, you know, customize my remarks to their audience a little bit, it gives you more credibility as you're speaking. And one of my challenges, you mentioned, Gail, earlier about being an inspirational speaker, one of my challenges is every time I go on stage, I try to be real. I try to really remember that moment and how I felt, and so I'm not just on autopilot, because I believe as an inspirational speaker, people remember what they feel almost more than what they hear. So I don't really call myself a motivational speaker. It's more of a combination of motivation and inspiration, but I just love inspiring people because I think when people feel something, it causes them to change and act and do things. And that's, as a speaker, what you want to do is cause positive change in your audience. So,
well, let's,
but yes, I do love healthcare, folks.
Well, let's kind of go to that moment and talk about, you know, kind of how you feel. Like, how, what was like the preamble to being shot? And then what were the moments like thereafter?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't even obviously thinking about that. I was just a quarterback on my way to football, sitting on his mom and dad's bed and, you know, in his mom and dad's bedroom. And then he walked around the corner with a gun. And, of course, being a little hunter and growing up with gun safety and all that, I spun that revolver around, a little Russian roulette, and pulled it up and pointed it at my chest and took the safety off and bang. And then I knew kind of what had happened. At first, I thought, oh, this can't be real. But then all of a sudden, my legs don't work. I can't breathe. My friend's freaking out. And I remember thinking, this is real. Mm-hmm. I've been shot. Mm-hmm. Oh, I panicked. I couldn't get to a phone. I knew my mom's five houses away. And so I was scared. I mean, it was just, I really literally thought I was dying. And that's, like I said, I started bargaining with heaven. And then fortunately, my friend came back in and started shaking me around. And I showed him the hole in my chest. And he went over to the blue phone on the wall, all this before cell phones. And he called my mom, and I waited for my mom, and I'll tell you what, those next 2 minutes were the longest 2 minutes of my entire world, but just knowing that my good mom might walk in that room, it actually gave me that hope that I needed to hang in there. So I like to say moms matter. Dads are decent, but moms, you really matter. So thank you.
So it took 2 minutes for your mom to get there. I mean, how long till like emergency services got there and all of that?
Yeah, so my mom got there, and then she called 911. Mm-hmm. And so my friend's dad's a policeman. He's cruising around the neighborhood in his police car, and it comes across his little radio that there had been a shooting at his address. So my mom and my friend's dad were like the first people there. So all this happened probably in 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, and I'm trying to survive on very little oxygen because my right lung was collapsed, and my friend was freaking out, but fortunately had just enough sense to make the phone call. And once my mom got there, then everything started turning for the better. So
how long were you in the hospital for, and what was recovery and rehab like for you?
Well, so 8 days in intensive care and then another few months in rehab. And so the whole process, you know, took a couple of months. But right at first, it was just a matter of they don't know if I'm going to live. Mm-hmm. You know, all the stuff you go through, surgeries and all the machines hooked up to you and punching holes in my lungs to get the fluids out of there. And my friend actually told everybody I shot myself for a few days. So that was kind of the narrative at first. And what else? I remember they took x-rays. Mm-hmm. They couldn't figure out how the bullet missed my heart. And they figured out when they took the x-rays, my heart was on an outbeat. And when I got shot, my heart was on an inbeat. Mm-hmm. So the bullet actually did clip the edge of my heart. Mm-hmm. But because my heart was on an inbeat, it didn't like rip the edge of my heart. So I could go into it. I don't want to bother you with details, but I feel very fortunate to be alive. Mm-hmm. There's 4 or 5 things that could have went different that could have caused me to die. But so yeah, I hung out in rehab, and I remember my football teammates dedicated the game to me the next day, and they lost 36-0. So that wasn't too good. And I remember being mad at God.
It was a thought that counts.
Yeah, they're not. They were the Dallas Cowboys. They never would have lost, but 36-0. But I was a quarterback, so I'm sure that was part of the problem. But, yeah, so my friends were, you know, flocking to the hospital, and my parents were sleeping there. And even my buddy that shot me showed up, and he gave me a book. I never forget, Tori handed me this book, and I opened it up and said, Mike, I'll never forgive myself, but I hope someday you will. And then he signed, Your Friend, Tor. So this was just all happening so quick, but I would be lying to you or anybody listening or anybody that when everybody went home, and it was just me and my thoughts, I really would go rock bottom. Yeah. And I'd think about, is it worth it? I've lost my identity. My girlfriend dumped me a couple days later. So I had those down moments. But you know what? I really wasn't raised to quit. And that's what I share with audiences is my journey. From having everything, losing everything, and then solid principles of putting everything back together. Because I don't believe it's just about me. I think anybody in any audience has things like this and just have to figure it out. So,
well, let's anyway, just say yeah. that any girl that breaks up with you a few days after being shot in the chest probably isn't worth it.
Oh, Kyle, I totally agree. Her name, by the way, was Annette Barton. Yeah. So
thank you. I was waiting for that. Just
well, can we fast forward to the fact that you are married and have children and fill listeners in on the happy ending there?
Oh, yeah. If you want to jump way ahead, life got better. I adjusted and finished school and got a master's degree in business and healthcare and got married and had kids and raised them and they're now all married and I got a beautiful wife. And, you know, this wasn't just all about me, my parents, my friends. This journey has been so many people nowadays, none of them even knew me when I was on my feet. Mm-hmm. And so they've only known me as the dude in the wheelchair, but there were so many good people, including my parents, including my wife, friends that were always there for me. And it's been about a team. You know, most things with businesses or whatever aren't just about one person. It's about a group of people working together.
I know I did jump kind of fast forward, but I just wanted people to know the girl dumped you, but it had a happy ending. So.
Oh, yeah. No, life's good. Yeah, I know I've been dumped by plenty of girls, but things are good. Yeah.
Another thing that happened along the way that I think would be fun to hear about is when you got involved, when you took your athleticism and you got involved with the Olympics, you know, and kind of what took place there, because I think you have a gold medal, right?
I think I do. Yeah. It's this little cute safe right behind me, but I take it and share it with audiences and people. But yeah, so my identity was sports. And then when I lost my legs, I'm thinking, oh, boy, I mean, I'm just nothing now, you know, just a chess player or whatever. But, yeah, so I lost all that. And then I started playing wheelchair basketball. And I remember my dad and I went in the backyard, and I shot a basket, and it didn't even get close. Mm-hmm. And he said, Mike, you can still be a great athlete. You're just going to have to do it different. So I started playing wheelchair basketball. I found out they had it in the Olympics. I found out it was still like real basketball, 10-foot hoops, referees. And so it helped me put a piece of my life back together. And just over time, I became good and got invited to try out for the Olympics and made a couple of Olympic teams and won a couple of gold medals and a bronze medal. And so, yes, that's a big part of my story from, you know, kind of like laying there, just nothing, can't even go to my football game, to representing the United States of America in the Olympics. And I do bring my medals when I speak, and I bring my bullet that I was shot with. And so it's a pretty cool contrast of here's this bullet that took everything, but really adversity can create these good things. And so it's a powerful part of the ending of my story is the bullet and the medals together around my neck. So, yes, I love basketball. And representing our country, it's been great.
Just on the basketball, especially the wheelchair basketball, have you seen like the new iteration of it? That's like the hardcore, like they have like the custom wheelchairs and they run into each other and they push each other over and they shoot and do all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh, heck yeah. No, guys are amazing athletes. They're living up on one wheel. They're falling over and getting back up. The national championship team this year, 2017, it was from Dallas, Texas.
Really?
The Dallas Mavericks wheelchair basketball team won the national championship. I founded and coach a team in Utah called the Wheelin' Jazz, the Utah Wheelin' Jazz. So we have teams around the country, but right there in Texas is the hotbed of wheelchair basketball. Great athletes, college scholarships at UTA, Texas Arlington. The Mavericks have won the national. Anyway, bottom line is wheelchair basketball is amazing. These kids are freaking athletes, and they are unbelievable. I'm just old now. I'm old school, but yes.
Yeah, and
it's a great game, and it's fast.
And if people are kind of like, when they, I think a lot of people, when they think wheelchairs, they think about grandma being pushed around by, like, you know, her caretaker. But if you watch one of these, like, basketball, wheelchair basketball games, I mean, they're getting after it. I mean, like, it's violent. I mean, they're really going after it.
Oh, very physical. Special chairs, you know, the wheels slant out so you can turn quicker and you don't smash your fingers. Guys were able to get up on one wheel. A lot of these guys don't live in wheelchairs, so they've got all the stomach muscles, leg muscles, hip muscles. So they're falling over and flipping right back up. And you can push these things 15 miles an hour, and you have to dribble and three-point lines. And no, if you've never seen it, I mean, it might sound slow. I had the same thought when I was first heard. I thought, oh, this will be stupid. Somebody will push me down the chair. I'm down the court in a wheelchair. No, it's not like that at all. It's very, very athletic.
Are you still involved in that, Mike?
I am. I retired. I played for 40 years. I played 20 years with our national team in the Olympic stuff, but I played total of 40 years. And just last year, the younger guys around here kind of pushed me aside and said, Mike, why don't you coach? And so, you know what? I thought, okay, it's been a good run. So now I'm coaching the Wheelin' Jazz, and I enjoy that as well. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, you know, we were talking a little bit about how you've been able to take your story and you really, that your whole motivation for being out there inspiring people is to help people and how you've done that, you know, with a focus on the healthcare industry. I also know that you've been very popular in education, particularly in your home state. And I think you come from a family of educators. Can you talk a little bit, you may have even had a booklet that you shared with the entire state. I'm kind of going back in my memory bank here, but I know you've done a lot.
No, you have a good memory. Oh, I'm impressed, Gail. Yeah, my early days, yeah, my dad was like a basketball coach, but he was a high school teacher. Okay. And then my uncles, and then I ended up teaching at Arizona State University. So I do come from a family of educators. And in my early days, I mean, clear back when I was 16, 18, 20 years old, I was going to dozens and even hundreds of schools and just sharing my story. And then eventually it evolved into a lot of teachers associations and, you know, whatever. And so, you know, just that world, my story resonates very well because of all my teachers that were around me that helped me, my friends were around that helped me. So I feel like my story fits very naturally in a lot of industries because it is an inspirational story. But yes, education, healthcare, financial industries, some of those just seem to be, you know, a natural fit for what I do. But yeah, that's kind of my early days, was just speaking at schools and little junior highs and high schools. And it's obviously evolved to corporate and associations and stuff like that. But I love the kids. Still to this day, I love sharing my story because it was all when I was their age.
Right.
And so they kind of relate with their hard times. You know, and I don't like to use the old line, if I can do it, they can too. But I think people do. They are smart. They hear your story and they kind of attach it to their world, and then maybe it helps them not be so depressed, or maybe they are able to reach their goals or different things like that. So it is good for kids and teachers, yeah.
So continuing, well, I guess really, I mean, taking education and then segueing it into like the next logical spot, which is like safety. I understand that that's something that you talk about, and you mentioned prior to being shot that you're a hunter and you grew up doing that, but now you have like a safety component. So I'm curious as to, you know, what the audience gets from you when talking about maybe it's not just gun safety, but just safety in general. What's the message there?
Yeah. No, I'm not anti-gun at all, but obviously a careless moment caused this. I like to say being casual causes casualties. But yeah, I have a talk called Put Your Safety On. And I talk about how my whole world changed when my friend took the safety off and made a mistake. And what I've heard when I get out in the safety world is, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but a lot of times these safety meetings are kind of boring or they're mandatory or whatever. Well, I don't want it to be that way. I want these people to hear a fun, entertaining, laughing, crying story. However, I want them to know this shouldn't have happened. And then when they see me sitting there in the wheelchair, legs don't work, bowel and bladder issues, problems, this and that, they're smart enough to go, oh, that didn't need to happen. That shouldn't have happened. So, and I talk about how there's no such thing as a bronze medal in safety. There's no such thing as a bronze medal in safety because all these companies want zero, you know, zero tolerance. And that makes sense. And so, yeah, I'm not some expert about you can't walk under a ladder or how to plug in this or that. But my story really causes people to have a good time, but realize it shouldn't happen.
So going back to that moment that you were shot, I mean, hindsight obviously is 20/20. What are some safety things that you, in reflection or upon reflection, would have said, hey, you know, maybe that was a bad decision? I mean, obviously, I mean, there's the salient ones, but I'm just kind of curious as to how you can take that and then transition it over to like texting and driving and this, that, and the other.
Oh yeah. With, you know, it depends on the company I'm speaking to, obviously. But a lot of times what happens is people just get so autopilot of doing their job, and occasionally there's not people watching. And so they'll take shortcuts or they'll do little things that if they'd have just been a little more cautious or followed the protocol, or maybe, you know, whatever. But I find people just, they don't take responsibility and they get tired of it and they haven't thought about it for 20 years and it's the same old job. And so it doesn't take much to cause a problem. You know, like I said, in my situation, a half an inch with my heartbeat mm-hmm. made a whole lot of difference. You know, to me, again, it's just the desire to, because what happens when someone gets hurt is this isn't just about you, it's about your family and it's your future. And what happens from a company standpoint is one accident completely kicks their insurance rates and all that stuff, their loss ratios, into a whole nother atmosphere. So these companies have a real desire to eliminate each and every one of these accidents. Sometimes it's just a finger cut off. Other times it's like you said, a driver's texting and they, you know, so it could be everything from small to large, but they all affect the workforce and the employees. And so not to get on a tangent, but I lost a gold medal. I lost one of my two gold medals because one of my teammates tested positive for drugs. Mm-hmm. So I like to make the point to companies or whatever that everything you do affects every single other person on the team, not just me and my little world. And so anyway, hopefully I kind of answered your question there, Kyle.
It does. And I like the fact that you mentioned that, like, you know, people take shortcuts. From my background, you know, working in pretty aggressive large sales teams, you know, we had a lot of different forcing mechanisms to make sure that we did a lot of, you know, quality control on the data input and the tracking of tasks and different things like that. Because if we didn't, things would just run amok. The data input into our system would be horrible and it would just clog us to a standstill. And so it's making sure that, you know, people are being very diligent and thoughtful in their actions or putting processes and procedures in place that would make that happen or ensure that it would happen rather than, you know, letting things go willy-nilly, like for 18 years or so.
Oh, yeah, and especially in some of these industries, like, in fact, right there in Texas, I've spoken at two or three of these electric co-ops. You know, where these guys are out climbing these power lines. Well, when you're dealing with stuff like that, these dangerous industries or these coal mines or whatever, you know, those industries especially can have high incidence of pretty serious accidents, you know. But, I mean, every company has safety issues, but some of the industries are very, they got to be extremely careful, some of these blue-collar stuff or oil and gas or whatnot. But yeah, you know, safety is just a... It's just a little niche of, you know, that I've kind of gotten into in the last year or two, but what I've learned, and you probably understand this being in the speaking world too, there was a time in my life I thought, does all this really matter? Does motivation, does it all really matter? Well, I've come full circle. You know, I'll go to these three-day things, and they learn about new products and territories and this and that. But, so that's all the head stuff. Well, I come along and I provide that heart stuff. And then so it really does matter to me. I really feel that these kind of speakers and motivators and inspiring, you know, presentations, I believe they do matter, especially if you have time in a day or two event to fit them in here or there. So yeah, I've come full circle. I believe what I do matters, both in the safety world and just the inspirational world.
I like that. You had a question, I think, about sales, right?
Well, I was just spent 3 days on site with a large company planning a global sales kickoff. And you just hit the nail on the head of what they were trying to balance. Like, there has to be content and there has to be curriculum and they have to share the latest tools and the latest products. But how do you tap the heart? And so I think you have been very popular with sales organizations. And it'd be interesting for you to kind of expand on how you think you fit into an agenda with a sales group.
Yeah, no, it's a little bit what you just alluded to, and probably half the sales speaking I've done has been in the financial world because I have my investment licenses. But you know what's funny? I don't get up there and talk about making a follow-up phone call or, you know, sending them a nice little note on their birthday. It's more about getting your heart, you know, wanting to do this and caring about your job and wanting to change. My favorite saying in my whole speech, if you resist change, you fail. If you accept change, you survive. If you create change, you succeed. And so it's very much, because a lot of the salespeople I speak to, they come to this meeting, they're shaking hands with all their coworkers, they get pumped up, And then they go back to Oklahoma or Massachusetts or Washington or whatever, and they have to wake up every day and get self-motivated to go back out there and to make that phone call. And so I feel my job is to just get them pumped up, to take personal responsibility and be self-motivated, and to know that, you know, that it's their work ethic that is just as important as having a good product. I could give an average product to an incredible salesperson, and they could sell it. I could give a great product to an average salesperson, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I really believe the person is as important as the product. So I just try to share my story to inspire people to get out there and believe in their products and believe in themselves. But yeah, I think sales, I don't know why. Maybe it's just because a lot of sales groups get together because they're kind of like the lifeblood of companies. But there's absolutely a lot of sales meetings going on and leadership meetings and whatever, yeah.
Well, you know, what I kind of like about that phrase that you just mentioned earlier is it kind of gives you – you really do have three options. It's not a binary, you know, choice, but it's a tertiary one. And so, you know, by resisting change, obviously you're going to fail. I mean, we could point to Kodak, who thought, you know, digital photos and photography wasn't going to take over and film was going to be around, and you can kind of see where that went. But I like the one where you talk about just accepting change versus creating change. And I was wondering if you could just expand on that just a little bit.
Well, go to my story. You know, it's normal when you have an accident or anything in life, a divorce or whatever. We all have these pains. You know, I look out into an audience, Kyle and Gail, and I don't see wheelchairs, but I see people that I know are dealing with stuff, divorces, depression, disease, diabetes, whatever. And your natural thing is to not want to change. So you just want this to go away. I wanted my legs to work again. I didn't want to be in a wheelchair. It's just the denial part. But eventually when you accept it and you own it and you take responsibility for it and it's real, it's not going away, now you start doing stuff. You set goals, you get creative, and you really find out about who you are. Can I do this or can I not? And it doesn't matter if it's a wheelchair or selling a product. It comes back to that individual being motivated and confident and believing in themselves. And so it's just very much to me comes down to the individual and what they're made of. But when you have something happen like it happened to me, it really tests you. You really find out about who you are. But most of the time you just can't make this stuff go away. You've got to deal with it and then you accept it. And then eventually, a lot of times you look back and you're like, oh, wow, I actually learned something from that. Mm-hmm. I actually became stronger. Now, I can literally say because of my wheelchair, I'm a better person in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I came full circle. I feel like I accepted this in my world when I was willing to talk about it with other people and actually get up on a stage. And this isn't about me and people laughing at me. It's about me looking them in the eyes and having a desire to help them. Because like I said, I know there's so much pain. I always challenge audiences and people to find a purpose in your pain. You're going to have pain. Find a meaning. Find a purpose in that pain because it makes the journey through all of it so much different and better. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think like a lot of people, I mean, there's a lot of dumb decisions I've made in my life, and there's a lot of bad things that have, you know, obviously I haven't been shot in the chest, but, you know, bad things have happened to me and they've happened to other people who are listening to this. And, you know, denial doesn't get you very far in life. Acceptance is a really, really good thing, but then being able to build off of that and not let that define you. I mean, you may have made a stupid purchasing decision on a solution and you fully invested in it in 3 years and it's just not paying off for you. But then eventually you just have to come to terms and say, hey, that was a bad idea. And then you have to pivot to something else and learn from that experience in a business sense or in a personal sense. Say, hey, I've spent the last 4 years eating pizza. Maybe I should not do that anymore. And so I like kind of that message that you're giving out there of saying not only do you have to accept it, but then use that as the benchmark from which you grow.
Yeah, yeah. No, and to me, it's all about owning it and taking responsibility. If I sat there the rest of my life, by the way, Kyle, you should be a motivational speaker. Your mom should book you. She really should.
Yeah.
In fact, you mentioned your childhood. I think we should spend 10 minutes having your mother tell us about your childhood. I think that would be
Let's not. There's really not enough cool. counseling time out there for that.
But no, but back to what we were talking about owning it and responsibility. You know what? If I sat here my whole life and said, every time people, why are you in a wheelchair? Oh, my friend shot me and you know, if he'd have done this, I'd have been okay. And, oh, man. You know, if his dad wouldn't have left that police gun over there. Oh, geez. You know, if you want to live in the world of fault and blame, you're not going to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so for me, the concept of personal responsibility, accountability, ownership, those things are so freaking critical, especially in the world of sales or in overcoming any kind of adversity. Mm-hmm. You know, companies go through change, and if each individual person doesn't own it and they're always fighting it, wanting it to be how it was before they were bought out, then that's just hard. You can live that way, but to me, you're not going to get very far.
Yeah. I was listening to another podcast the other day, and it was not ours, so that's why I'm not going to mention it. But I was listening to it, and they were talking about somebody transitioning from an individual contributor role to like a management role, and how, you know, a lot of people, when they do that, they want to blame fault or find fault in everybody else but themselves. And they're not taking responsibility for the performance of the team. You know how they bring someone onto the sales team and, you know, setting them up for success. If they fail, it's not them failing. It's that you failed them, and owning that from beginning to end. Unless, of course, they do something stupid. But, you know, we can always find that.
Yeah, you know, and people, I actually like it when people do stuff for the team, even though it's a personal thing, like if you're on a basketball team or a football team. Mm-hmm. You know, I played tennis and whatever those individual sports, but I think when you're a part of a team, I don't know, it kind of makes you want to hold your part up for the rest of the team. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're an offensive lineman, you don't want Dak Prescott to get killed or Ezekiel Elliott to get smashed. So I just think there's something about teams that, you know, but the personal responsibility, I love the word responsibility. If you break it down, it's responsibility. We all have the ability to respond. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a powerful concept. But it is a team thing. And, you know, if that's whatever provides that motivation for somebody to do their job, mm-hmm. to care, that's to me, whatever it takes to find that within a human being, that's what matters. But we lose so many people. You know, I see it in people's eyes. They're depressed or they're tired or they don't want to do this anymore because they're 50 years old. And we've just got to find a way to light that fire mm-hmm. within us. And anyway, just giving you my little personal belief about how humans, when I'm speaking, I don't always sit there and think, oh, I'm talking to a bunch of sales reps. Mm-hmm. My mind thinks I'm talking to people. They have problems. Mm-hmm. They need hope and they need inspiration. And I get, you know, oftentimes if I sell a book afterwards, I'll get all kinds of emails. Thanks, Mike, for helping me get my head in the right place. Thanks, Mike, for helping me to quit feel sorry about the divorce I'm going through. And so that's what matters to me, because if I can get rid of that crap, they will be a better employee. Mm-hmm. If I can help them find hope in their cancer they're going through, they will be a better employee. So it's almost like I personally talk to people. I don't sit there and think, oh, I'm just talking to a bunch of, you know, sales reps. That's the way my mind thinks about my audience.
Yeah, it's a deeper level, you know. Like when you were talking about Dak Prescott, I'm thinking, well, when I was in high school, Christian Ponder was my quarterback. I think he owes me a royalty check from his NFL pay because I made him look good
probably
in high
does.
School. Darn right. Christian Ponder. Pay your boy.
What position did you play, Kyle?
I was the pulling guard. I was the fastest lineman and the biggest one on the team.
Okay. So, yeah, you had to block for those guys, and they probably freaking never said thanks to you.
Man, my highlight reel was awesome. It was so good. I'd pull, and then, you know, I'd run down the line, and then Christian would run right behind me. I'd blow somebody out, get a concussion because I had a lot of those, and then he would keep running.
Exactly. And then my wife's from Minnesota, and every time they interviewed Christian Ponder, he never mentioned Kyle Davis. Never Kyle. Yeah, never once.
Never once.
I was so ticked. I'm like, mention the guy that blocked. He's concussions. He's probably struggling. Anyway, yeah.
Clearly, based on that new
report.
Sorry,
Kyle, we're getting off on a sports tangent here. Yeah. I love sports, if you can't tell.
Yeah,
no, I love it. I mean, I love the high school glory days. That was so much fun.
Yeah, he should definitely pay for, like, my CTE therapy or something like that.
Yeah. Were your mom and dad, like, yelling in the stands at the coaches, or what were your parents like in the audience?
Well, you know, we had, like, 20,000 people come to a football game. So to say that I could hear my parents would be a lie.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that, you know, my mom knew exactly what was going on.
Not at all. I'm a cheerleader at heart, so I'm always there cheering everyone on. But people would say to me, Gil, did you just see that play? And I'd be like, no, I was visiting.
So, oh, yeah. I wasn't watching number 76 or whatever your number was. Yeah,
it was 55 and my brother was 56.
55, 57.
55, 56, and that's one played defense and one played offense. There really should have been no communicating with other people. It should have been strictly focused on the field at all times. But, you know, parenting.
Well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Now, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm glad we got to tap into some of your passions, because I know sports is a big one of them. And
you do have a book, though, right?
Yep, it's called Shot Happens.
Could you get, I mean,
and the subtitle is I got shot. What's your problem?
God, such a good one.
You? What paralyzes you? So it's kind of that question. So I don't want to, let me tell you one other little piece of my story. It's kind of interesting. My friend shot me, told everybody I shot myself. Then he got involved in drugs and started robbing banks. Then he went to prison for 25 years in Fort Leavenworth. Then I reconnected with him about 10 years ago. But that story about he and I, I broke my arm right after I got shot, and then so he came to visit me in the hospital, and I remember it was a turning point for me. I let it go. I no longer really blame my friend. And so I talked to, I try to tell people about, you got to let it go. What do you have that you got to let go? What paralyzes you? It's back to what I was just saying about my book. What stops you? What fears? What walls are you building around you? Because for me, for a few years, it was my friend, and then I just completely let it go that day he visited me after I broke my arm in the hospital. But anyway, I don't know why I just threw that in. I just wanted to mention that, but go ahead. Sorry.
What happened when you reconnected with him?
Oh, it was cool. I was in a restaurant, and he called me, and he was close, and I told him to come over there, and he went to shake my hand, and I went to shake it. You know, you stick your hands out like two cool guys. He came and knelt down right next to me, and we hugged and we talked, and I, you know, reassured him that I don't blame any of my problems on him. We talked about him going to prison and how that's changed his world for 25 years and how he blames his dad for everything. So we just had a good talk, but I'm proud of my friend. He has his life positioned very properly now. He's got a job, a girlfriend. I don't call him every day and go to lunch or anything, but he's in the Salt Lake area here and doing better and out of prison and got jobs. And so anyway, yeah. So, again, it's not about me. He's had his own journey, and I think that's a powerful message, is there's just always different sides of every situation. So I'm proud of my friend.
Well, one of the things that you did just talk about, and I know we've brushed up against it a few times, but, you know, these mental barriers that people, these walls that they throw up, you know, whether it be like resentment or like, you know, too much pride or something like that. And I just like how the fact that you just said you have to let it go sometimes. Like, you know, you have to just acknowledge what your deficit is and just let it go.
Just let it go. We don't need to spend our lives blaming everybody else for our problems. Let it go. I like to say when I took the bullet out of my back, I got the lead out. You know, quit sitting on our butt. Let it go. It's okay. And move on. I mean, you have to go through the natural steps, denial, bargaining, all that stuff, acceptance we talked about. But ultimately, if you've got walls built around you, if your whole world's all about fear, you're in trouble. So we got to break down those walls and acknowledge their problems and face them. And, you know, a lot of times if I can, when I've challenged somebody to find their bullet, if I can get them to go grab that one thing that they've always been using as an excuse, my ex-wife or this, you know, if they can tackle that and throw it aside and let it go, it's amazing how much the river just flows better. It's just so much more natural. And,
Well, if you want help finding your bullet and then having it pulled out of your back, you can do so by contacting GDA Speakers, and we'll get Mike Schlappi to come and speak for you. And I think this is a good time for us to put a bow on this. So if you do want to contact us, you can at 214 well, I almost gave my cell phone right there. 214-420-1999 or by going to gdaspeakers.com. For the transcript, the book, and everything else, you can go to gdapodcast.com. With that being said, Mike, it was awesome. Thank you.
It was great. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers. If you're interested in booking today's guest, visit GDA Speakers at gdaspeakers.com or call 214-420-1999. Visit gdapodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter to stay up to date and be informed of new episodes, blog posts, and more. Be sure to follow GDA Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at GDA Podcast, as well as Facebook at facebook.com/GDA Podcast. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more from GDA Podcast and GDA Speakers.